प्रतिवैष्णव प्रतिवैष्णव की जय रामाचार्य शिव हरिदास ठाकुर की जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री द्वैत गदाधर श्रीवास हरि गौर भक्तवृंद की जय श्री राधा कृष्ण गौर गोपीनाथ श्याम कुंड राधा कुंड गिरि गोवर्धन की जय वृंदावन धाम की जय मथुर धाम की जय नवद्वीप मायापुर धाम की जय जगन्नाथ पुरी धाम की जय गंगमय जूनी देवी की जय भक्ति देवी की जय तुलसी महारानी की जय समवेत भक्तवृंद की जय All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Sri Prabhupada Nama Om Vishnu Padaya. Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Sri Mate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti. Namaste, Saraswati Deve, Gauravani Kacharne, Nirvasesha Srinivadi Paskatyade Satarne, Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Utapada Kamalam Sri Guru Vaishnavam Chashu, Vikam Sarvajatam Sahagana, Raghunatam Vikam Stam Sujitam, Sadvaitam Sadvaditam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam, Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana, Lavita Sri Vishakam Vitam Stra, Panchakalpa Tribhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyebhyo Patitanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavebhyo Namaha Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya November 27, 2015, Skype class from Hilo, Hawaii, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 7, further inquiries by Vidura, Text 38. Purushasya cha samsthanam
Purushasya cha
Swarupam ba parasticha Yanam cha naigamam Yattad Gurusisya prajojanam Purushasya Of the living entity Cha Also Samsthanam Existence Swarupam Identity Va Either parasya of the supreme cha also jnanam knowledge cha also nigamam in the matter of the Upanishads yat that tat the same guru spiritual master shishya disciple cryogenam Necessity. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. What are the truths regarding the living entities and the Supreme Personality of Godhead? What are their identities? What are the specific values in the knowledge in the Vedas? And what are the necessities for the spiritual master and his disciples? Purport. The living entities are constitutionally servitors of the Lord, who can accept all kinds of service from everyone. It is clearly declared in Bhagavad Gita 5:29 that the Lord is the supreme enjoyer of all the benefits of all sacrifices and penances, the proprietor of all that is manifested, and the friend of all living entities. That is his real identity. Therefore, when the living entity accepts this supreme proprietorship of the Lord and acts in that attitude, he resumes his real identity. In order to elevate the living entity to the standard of knowledge, there is necessity of spiritual association. The bona fide spiritual master desires that his disciples know the process of rendering transcendental service to the Lord, and the disciples also know that they have to learn about the eternal relationship between God and the living entity from a self-realized soul. To disseminate transcendental knowledge, one must retire from mundane activities on the strength of enlightenment and knowledge in terms of Vedic wisdom. That is the sum and substance of all the questions in this verse. Purushasya cha samsthanam swarupam va parasya cha jnanam cha naigamam yat tad purushasya prayojanam. What are the truths regarding the living entities and the supreme personality of Godhead? What are their identities? What are the specific values in the knowledge in the Vedas? And what are the necessities for the spiritual master and his disciples? So this is a very dense verse. One could delve into this verse for years. So it is explained in Srila Prabhupada's purport that when one understands the nature of God, the Swarupam, the real existence of God, then one naturally understands one's sthanam, one's place in relationship to God. But one can only understand this through saintly association. And when one understands this through saintly association, or to be saintly association, one must factually experience this relationship, which naturally has as a concomitant factor that one will retire from all mundane activities. So to know God, Swarupam, his form. People often think in the modern day that God has no form. How could God have a form? It would be limiting for him to have a form. Because we think of form in terms of our own body. Our own body is so limiting. We can only work so hard, and then our bodies scream for sleep. Our bodies demand food. Right? Our bodies demand some kind of shelter. And we can only be in one place at a time. Our ability to know is so limited. And it's quite interesting that in the Bhagavad Gita, the words used for the body of a conditioned soul, like deha and sharira, are never used for Krishna. Krishna doesn't. He's not a dehi, shariri, deha, bhuta, deha, vad. He's not any of those things. He doesn't have a body. So when we say swarupam, it's quite different. And 21 times in the Bhagavad Gita, the word rupa is used. And it's used only for Krishna. It's not used at all for the material bodies of the living entity. And rupa not only means form, but it also means a handsome form, loveliness, grace, beauty, and splendor. So when we're saying, what is the form, when Vidura is asking, what is the form of the Lord, swarupam, he's not asking anything in relationship to dehi or sarira of the living entities. We cannot be said to have rupa. So what is this form of the Lord? It's something inconceivable. Achincha rupam, in fact, Krishna tells Arjuna, it's an inconceivable form. We cannot understand such a form with our material senses. Even to see the cosmic form of the Lord, Arjuna required divine vision. And as soon as we understand janma karma chame divyam eva myo veti tatvata tvaktva deham punar janma naiti mam eti sorjuna. Tvaktva deham, when we give up this deha, this material form, we will attain to our original position if we understand the form of the Lord. So such is one of the main points in this verse. As soon as we understand who God is, then immediately we will understand ourselves. And such is one of the main things that a religion should offer. If someone says, this is a religion, then one of the main things they should offer is this knowledge. In fact, such is described here in the purport, that to be a bona fide guru, one must have this enlightenment. One must know. If you don't know what is God, how can you be a guru? How can you be a religion? I think many of us who took up Krishna consciousness as adults who had been raised in another religion, one of our frustrations was the lack of knowledge in these other religions. Right? They're just not giving proper information. Could you imagine if someone says, I'm a doctor, but I don't understand the workings of your body? What kind of a doctor is that? Here's a restaurant, but we don't serve any food. You know, what kind of a restaurant is that? A clothing store, but we don't sell any clothes. So someone says, we're a religion, but we can't give you information about God. How is it a religion? And the sad reality is that most of the people on the earth who are propounding a particular religion, whatever they may be, whether they're a priest, minister, imam, rabbi in that religion, or whether they're just some door-to-door salesman of the religion coming by with their magazines, if you say to them, what is God? They don't know. So here, Srila Prabhupada so nicely, not just explaining the question of Vidura, but giving somewhat of the answer. who is God and what is our relationship with him. And, all right, well, how can I actually experience this? And then Prabhupada says, through association of the saintly persons. And then he explains, what is this saintly person and this guru? One has to have a relationship of guru and shishya, and that relationship is defined, as Krishna also says in the Gita, through actually being taught vidarshi, through experiencing the truth. So who is God? Well, he has this beautiful, inconceivable form. And his beautiful, inconceivable form, although experienced somewhat differently by each worshipper according to their own desire, as Lord Kapiladeva says, everybody sees the form of the Lord somewhat differently, in a different mood. Still, there's some commonality between the description of the Lord's form. So it's very effulgent, it's very brilliant, although generally the Lord's form is described as dark. Of course, those who see the Lord as Balaram, as Sankarsana, see him as having a very light-colored form. And the Song of Solomon in the Bible, the Lord's form is also described as being very light-colored. But why either of those? And of course, the Lord has different colors in his different incarnations. Sometimes he appears reddish as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Gauranga, he appears as golden. But whatever color he appears in, he is certainly full of light. Even his dark form, Shyamasundar, is full of light. So he's very effulgent. And his original form is human-like. We are made in the image of God. But he has unlimited forms, Anantarupam. And all the forms that we see in this world are modeled after some form of the Lord. The Lord has forms that look like birds and insects and animals and trees. And all of the, it's said in the Bhagavatam, the Lord incarnates in every species, or as a demigod. Vamana appears among the demigods and so forth. Vishnu appears among the demigods. And his original form still is human-like, with two hands and two legs and two eyes and one nose and one mouth. I mean, in his cosmic form, he had many, many, many eyes, many, many bellies, many, many hands, many, many faces expanded, thousands and thousands without limits. But in his original form, he is very human-like. And what is his nature? So that could be explained in many ways. So we'll go with Srila Prabhupada's choice in this particular purport, that he's referencing Bhagavad Gita 5.29, Bhaktaram Yagatapasam Sarvalokamaheshram Suridam Sarvabhutanam Gyatramam Shanti Nichiti. So we could also explain Krishna by the 64 qualities that Rupa Goswami gives in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. We could explain God by Rupa Goswami's description of the four aspects of Krishna's personality, Dhirodhata, Dhirodhata, Dhiralalita, Dhiraprasanta, which he gives many further explanations of in his Uttamanyamani. And we could explain Krishna's nature, so many of the different ways he explains himself in the Bhagavad Gita and the Brahma Sanhita throughout the Bhagavatam and so forth. But we're going to stick to these three, although, as I said, it's not the only way. So he's the supreme enjoyer of all of everything that we do. So generally, as conditioned souls, we think that we are the supreme enjoyer of everything that we do. I've done something, and I've done it for me to enjoy. And the reason that we know that we think this way is we get very upset when we do something, we do some sacrifice or penance. Everything we do is a sacrifice or a penance of something, and we don't get any pleasure out of it. I mean, even if someone's sitting around watching the television show of the football game, they're sacrificing their time. They're sacrificing their energy. They're giving their time and energy. And if the game is not enjoyable, if the teams don't play a good game, or if their team doesn't win or whatever, they become angry. Oh, I did this to get some pleasure out of it, and I didn't get any pleasure out of it. I spent all my money on my vacation, all my time and my energy, all my sacrifice, all my penance, and it just rained the whole time, and my kid got sick, and the people who worked at the resort area weren't pleasant to me. So I didn't get any pleasure out of it. And then we become angry. And as such, as we're going to say frankly, generally the reason for divorce, for all of the difficulty we have in our life, that I've given, and I didn't get, I wasn't the enjoyer. You know, and of course we have a problem when you have so many living entities who each want to be the enjoyer. So if I'm sacrificing and you want to enjoy my sacrifice, and I want to enjoy my sacrifice, there's going to be a conflict. And therefore we have so many conflicts in this world. But if one understands that Krishna is the enjoyer, and that is his identity, then we will understand ourselves. Again, one of the main points here is as soon as we understand the Lord, then we understand ourselves. Samsthanam. Purushasya cha samsthanam. Where does the living entity stand? What is the living entity's identity? So the living entity's identity is to sacrifice for Krishna's enjoyment. And even saying such a thing, we tend to recoil inside. I have to sacrifice for someone else's enjoyment. How is that? Well, that's our essential rebelliousness. Why should I sacrifice for someone else's enjoyment? Right? The people in the capitalist countries, they're screaming and crying that the workers are sacrificing while the CEOs get these multi-million dollar paychecks. You know, here I'm the worker and I'm not getting much money. I'm scrimping and saving. I can't afford to send my child to a good college and I can't afford to buy fancy food and so forth. And the person for whom I'm sacrificing, the CEO, is paying himself $230 million a year. So we think it's going to be like that with God. I'm going to sacrifice for his enjoyment. And of course, we have some concept of sacrificing for the enjoyment of another in this world, the person who sacrifices for their country, so their country will enjoy, the person who sacrifices for their family, they sacrifice for their religion, and people will make extreme sacrifices. They will sacrifice their life, their health, and so forth. So we have some concept like that I sacrifice so someone else will enjoy. But of course, in this world, the concept is still that then I will enjoy. So why is it that when we understand that Krishna is the supreme enjoyer and I sacrifice for his enjoyment, that it's different? And the reason is that he is the antaryami, and he is the paramatma. He is the self of the self. We are truly part of him. I am not truly part of my family. I'm not truly part of my country or my football team or my job or my religious society. I'm not truly part of any of those things. And therefore, when I sacrifice for those things, I become disappointed because I don't really have a connection. I mean, I was thinking the other day of that, okay, well, if I were to die now, my youngest grandchildren would not remember me. They wouldn't even really remember who I was. And thinking more about that, I thought, well, what is the me that I'm thinking they would remember? It's simply a constructed identity. It's a temporary identity. And who are they? They also have a constructed identity. It would be like saying, you know, we're both actors on the same stage production, and the character being played by another actor, would that character remember my character played by me as an actor? Right? There's not really a connection. There's not really a connection. If I'm in a drama with someone, and in the drama we're sisters, it doesn't mean that we're actually sisters. You know, there's many instances of actors playing together as husband, wife, brother, and sister, but off the stage they have no relationship, or they may even have an antagonistic relationship. So I'm not really part of this family or this society or this nation, this religion, this ethnicity, and so forth. And therefore, all of the clamoring for women's rights and black rights and Sunni and Shiite and this and that are all really nonsensical. But with Krishna, I am actually part of Krishna. I really and truly am eternally part of Krishna. That is a real identity. And when I sacrifice for his enjoyment with no thought of my own enjoyment, then I really and truly feel completely satisfied, exactly like when my hand sacrifices for the good of the body, the hand becomes nourished because the hand is indeed part of the body. When the cells in my body, of course they're doing it unconsciously, but when the cells in my body work for the good of the whole body, they also become nourished and happy. So this is our real relationship. And again, once we understand God, once we understand that, wait a minute, God is the whole of which I am part, then we naturally sacrifice for his enjoyment. The proprietor of all that is manifest, and he owns everything. And the fact that God owns everything is perhaps one of the biggest frustrations of the conditioned souls. And one of the biggest sources of our fear and anger and anxiety and frustration. That I don't really own anything. know, I really don't own anything. And of course, we experience our lack of ownership on a small level. Right now in the world, there's so much talk of the Syrian refugees. Of course, there's also refugees from many other countries, many African countries and so forth. There's many wars going on in the world. But these people had a home, they had a business, they had a family, they had a job, they had so many things. And then some bomb comes along. In this case, it's a civil war in Syria. And then everything's gone. Everything they owned has disappeared. Where is their proprietorship? If they say it's mine, it's mine. It's no, we'll simply destroy it. So where is our proprietorship? Everything that we claim is ours, we can lose at any time. We become so shocked, right? You know, my health is mine. I have a friend who recently got diagnosed with cancer, right? And these kind of things are such a shock. Oh, I thought that I had good health. I thought I owned my good health. I thought I owned my intelligence. I thought I owned my money. But at any time, it can be taken away in whole or in part, with or without warning. And that means it belongs to somebody else. If I'm letting you use something and I can take it even without warning, then I am the proprietor. So the ultimate proprietor, of course, is not another person or the government, but the ultimate proprietor is God, who doesn't even have to give notice. He can just, you know, we turn around and something that we depended on, something that we felt was ours, is gone. So if he's the real proprietor, then also everything we're doing with everything should be done to please that proprietor. You know, if I'm driving someone else's car, I want to drive that car in a way that will give that person happiness. Right? And I don't have my own car, and when I drive someone else's car, which is the only kind of car I drive, then I'm very conscious of that. How do I park the car? How do I drive the car? How am I using the fuel in the car? All of these things have to be pleasing to the proprietor. The fact that I'm not the proprietor dictates what I can do with someone else's property. So when we have this knowledge that God is the proprietor, then we act in a way that will please the proprietor with our body, with our mind, with our money, with our relations. Otherwise, frankly, we are thieves. At the very least, we should offer a portion of what we do. That's at the very least, that's karma kanda, that's not really bhakti. But some portion, some tithe that one offers in sacrifice. Otherwise, we are a thief. But actually, everything should be done as an offering, because whatever we have, it already is his. It already is his. You know, if I'm cooking in someone else's kitchen, which is the only kind of kitchen I cook in, then I'm going to cook what other people want me to cook in a way that they want me to cook it. I'm going to, just like I have, I often cook at the homes of either of my sons, but they have different ways they want the dishwasher loaded, and they're particular. They want it loaded this way, and the other one wants it loaded that way. And if I'm going to be loading someone else's dishwasher, I do it in the way that they want it done. So this also gives me an idea, what is my identity? And again, we tend to rebel against this. We say, well, what about my autonomy? What about my autonomy? What about my deciding what I want to do? So that means if everything is Krishna's property, I have to only do what he wants. Do I become like a machine? You know, like right now I'm using a microphone, I'm using a recorder, I'm using a computer. So these are insentient machines. They have no free will. They have no agency. And they generally do what I want them to do, right? And if they don't do what I want them to do, then I use force. I'm going to reprogram them, or, you know, or I get rid of them, replace them with one who will do what I want them to do. So if we want to depict in some kind of literature, drama, so forth, an evil person, it's a person who deals with other humans or animals as if they were machines without agency. We're just going to force them. A lot of the complaints nowadays about the slaughterhouse industry is how the animals are forced with various kinds of drugs and practices to get very fat in a very short amount of time, for example, and to develop the kind of meat that they want them. And this is Even ordinary people who eat meat consider such practices very demoniac and very cruel, that you should let the animal live out its life in a natural way and so forth. Of course, so then they want to kill it, which is hypocrisy. But the point is that when someone is treating another living entity as if they're a machine, you have to do what I want. And if you're not going to do what I want, I'm going to force you. Right? Someone is, particularly from men to women, or sometimes it goes in the other direction. But, you know, the man who says to the woman, you do what I want, if you don't do what I want, I will hit you, I will hurt you, I will beat you. So this is, it's demoniac, that you are my possession to do what I want. And if you don't do what I want, I'm going to try to force. So we may think Krishna is like that. We may think that when Krishna is the proprietor, and that means that we have to do everything exactly the way he wants, and we lose our agency, we lose our individuality. I mean, it's interesting, as a sort of a side note, that people who understand this concept of God as the proprietor often think like this, and they'll even preach like this. There are many religions based on this idea that one has to give up all of one's autonomy and all of one's agency. And you see such philosophies manifest in the relationship between the religious leaders and the followers, where the followers feel they have to give up all autonomy and agency and become like robots to the leaders. You'll see it in their preaching about men and women, that women have to give up all their personalities and engage like robots of the men. And what do we call this sort of behavior? We call it cultish. And in fact, just to be very honest, we've seen this sort of behavior in some pockets even of our Hare Krishna movement, not altogether, but in some places, some leaders who will teach like this. I mean, I hear it now from some quarters, and there are certainly whole religions that preach like this. So such is not a fact. Krishna does not enjoy matter. Krishna does not enjoy machines. He does not enjoy the material energy. Krishna enjoys living entities who are alive and have agency and have autonomy. Just like I was talking about cooking in my son's kitchen. So I have to cook something they like, but I still have autonomy. It's not that they give me a particular recipe. When I was a baker in a Marriott hotel, it was like that. They gave me the recipes, and I had to cook what they wanted me to cook according to their recipes and using their ingredients. And we had to cook, you know, this kind of cake on Monday and this kind of cake on Tuesday. But when I'm cooking in my children's kitchens, it's not like that. I can decide, oh, what do I want to make? Do I want to make chapatis today? Do I want to make puris? Do I want to make cornbread? You know, well, what do I want to make? So I have my parameters of what I can do. You know, certain things I'm going to do, they'll say, no, we don't like that. You know, you shouldn't have used all the butter today, etc. But I still have my autonomy. And they like being surprised. Right? They like, grandma's cooking today. I wonder what she's going to make. And they like coming to the meal. Oh, you made this, you made that. So Krishna's also like that. In fact, there's a lot of research that shows that relationships will die as soon as the element of surprise is gone. So as soon as you feel you know somebody backwards and forwards and upside down and you know exactly what kind of answer they would give, that the whole relationship dies. So Krishna's not like that. He likes mystery. He likes his devotees surprising him. He likes his, you know, seeing what new thing his devotees will do within the limits of what Krishna wants. And as Prabhupada said, Krishna's not narrow or stereotyped. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that Krishna is happy with anything as long as it's done out of love and not envy. And the last one here, Krishna is the supreme friend. In fact, Krishna is the supreme friend really is what colors everything else. So not only is he the enjoyer of all sacrifices and the proprietor of everything, but he really loves us. And isn't that what we want? Isn't that ultimately what we're looking for? Whether people want to amass large amounts of money or fame or power or beauty or strength or any of the opulences, wisdom, renunciation, what we're really looking for is a friend. We're really looking for somebody who values us, who finds us fascinating, who has affection for us, and who really values us, that we're important to them and is there for us when we need them. So the three markers of love. And those of us who don't have such a person in our life, at least one such person in our life, things are very painful for us. And Everybody needs this. Everyone needs. And if they don't have a human, as Prabhupada will often say, then they'll get an animal. And they imagine that this animal has affection for me and values me and is there for me. It's an imagination because the animal is really there for themselves. But they're thinking like that. You know, oh, I come home from work and the dog licks my face and jumps up and down and is so excited to see me. The dog is fascinated by me and the dog values me and the dog will defend me if some attacker comes in the house and so forth. But really, the dog is working more or less by instinct as part of like a wolf pack and is really thinking about themselves. It's not what it appears to be. But this is what we're looking for. And this is our relationship with Krishna. Knowing that Krishna is our supreme friend, that Krishna always finds us fascinating, that Krishna always thinks that we're very, very, very important. Each of us, little insignificant, tiny grains of dust within the billions of universes, and Krishna thinks each of us is important, and that Krishna is always there for us. He's always protecting us. He's always taking care of us. And once we understand that that's his situation, then we can understand that our situation is to reciprocate and be a friend to him. And be like that for him, to find him fascinating, to value him, and to always be there for him when he needs us. Of course, he doesn't need us in a materialistic sense. So that is knowing God, and knowing God, knowing ourselves. That as soon as we know God as the enjoyer, we know our role as to provide him with enjoyment, the proprietor, to use things as he desires, and as the friend, to be his friend. So how are we going to learn this? How are we, you know, it seems very theoretical. What do I do? How do I sacrifice for Krishna's enjoyment? How do I have him as the proprietor? How do I have him as the friend? And we were mentioning that these things can be grossly misunderstood, and often are grossly misunderstood. We put some material thing on it and preach that as religion and mislead people, mislead ourselves, discourage ourselves. And so many people, I mean, uncountable numbers of people get discouraged with God and get discouraged with religion by the misunderstanding of the nature of God. So one has to understand this through the association of saintly persons, and particularly with this guru-disciple relationship. Not just the association of saintly persons as friends, which is certainly important, undoubtedly important, essentially important, to have sadhu sangha as friends. But it is also, there is a necessity, prayojana, which is usually translated as the goal, probably translating here as a necessity, to have a relationship with at least one saintly person as guru shishya. As guru shishya. So, you know, we have experience that most people don't want to really be a shishya. Again, they're afraid that they'll lose their agency and their autonomy. So, you know, they may take guru simply as a fashion, and Prabhupada says this many times. And we've experienced this, we have to say again, even very commonly within the Hare Krishna movement, that somebody takes a guru, oh, here's my guru, I'm going to put my guru's picture on the altar. But when the guru says something even very small, even if the guru says, you know, oh, that painting that you have on the wall of Krishna, it's not properly done. It's disrespectful to Krishna. Please, you should take it down. Oh no, but I like it, they say. So this is, you know, or you have this deity, you have a Shalagram Shila, you're only worshiping once a month. You need to worship him every day, or you need to give him away. Oh, I'm just going to do what I want. Oh, you're living together, man and woman, without marriage. You need to get married. Oh, we're going to do what we want. So this guru-shishya relationship, it has to be one where we really worship the guru as good as God. Sakshad Hari Tvena Samasta Shastya. Hari Tvena, not that the guru is God in a technical sense. The guru is not lifting Govardhan Hill, and I'm not going to have, you know, some vatsalya, madhurya relationship with the guru, whatever my relationship is with Krishna. Not like that. But that here's a representative of God. Here's the person who's really going to steer me in the right direction. Otherwise, I have so much risk of putting my own personal and material conceptions on God and interpreting God in the wrong way and going in the wrong direction. And one could spend lifetimes going in the wrong direction. Rupa Goswami says there are weeds packed up with the bhakti creeper, and they may look very much like the bhakti creeper. And over and over and over and over and over again, we find that people will do things and preach things and say things, and when their guru corrects them, they don't take it. They say, no, no, I'm going to do things in my own way. So without that, it's just not going to... Eva Bhagachet. It's absolute necessity. One has to accept a guru actually, really, truly. You know, one has to accept the guru the way that the guru wants. Now, does that mean that everything the guru does is perfect? Well, yes and no. Yes and no, because the guru is not God. If we expect that the guru is God when the guru is just a jiva, and then we'll also be disappointed. Just like Srila Prabhupada notes when Krishna tells Arjuna, many, many births have passed. I remember all of them, but you do not, O chastiser of the enemy. So even a liberated soul like Arjuna isn't omniscient and omnipotent and so forth like God. That's not what we're looking for in a guru. So what are we looking for? And this is also mentioned in this verse, that, as Prabhupada said, that to disseminate transcendental knowledge, in other words, to be a guru, one must retire from mundane activities on the strength of enlightenment and knowledge in terms of the Vedic wisdom. So the person we are looking for a guru, should be someone who's enlightened in knowledge according to the Vedas, and who on the strength of that enlightenment has given up mundane activities. So that's a very deep criteria, which we're not going to get into in all of its depth by any means, but to look at it at least in a basic way. So the guru has to be in terms of the Vedic wisdom. Stotriyam Brahmanistam is another, is the Upanishadic statement. So stotriyam means that I've heard, the guru has heard from the Vedas. They're not making up their own kind of enlightenment. So we have people who make up their own definitions of enlightenment. You know, well, my definition of enlightenment is that I can visualize all my chakras spinning within me. Okay, well, that's kind of cool, but that's not the Vedic wisdom as to what's ultimate enlightenment. What is ultimate enlightenment? That one is realizing that God is in everything, that everything is His, that they belong to Him. That is the definition of the truth, to see the truth, bhoktaram yakatapasam sarvalokmahesham suridam sarvabhutanam gyatvamam shantimichiti. And by seeing the truth, one will gain this peace, gyatvamam shantimichiti. There's evidence procedures. One will gain humility. Perhaps the biggest evidence procedure is that one is truly humble. One doesn't have, the guru doesn't have a pride of, I am the guru. As soon as a person thinks, as Bhaktisiddhanta says, I am guru, they become gauru or cow. They become like some foolish animal. So one who's really experiencing Krishna by virtue of the Vedic wisdom will develop these qualities of a sadhu, particularly absence of desire for pratistha, for fame, and will develop this very, very deep humility. I am simply the servant. The real guru is also a shishya. The real guru is also a disciple. We see that the real guru follows his or her guru. The real guru doesn't have a guru simply as an ornament. And this enlightenment enables the guru to give up mundane activities. You know, it's possible to give up mundane activities for a very long time through other means. So it's possible. A person can, by force or by trick or by habit, restrain themselves from various material activities. I mean, there are people who follow no illicit sex, no meat eating, no intoxication, no gambling, for various reasons other than spiritual enlightenment. So just that is not enough. It's necessary but not sufficient. One should see that the guru has retired from mundane activities on the strength of enlightenment. On the strength of enlightenment. So because of enlightenment, Prabhupada would make this point over and over and over again, that one should give up sense gratification on the strength of advancement in Krishna consciousness by having the positive. So just like advice for people who are addicted to bad habits is, don't try to get rid of the bad habit, but replace it with a better habit. Getting rid of a bad habit is almost impossible. Replacing it with a good habit is much easier. So by following in the path of the Mahajana, Mahajaniyena Gata Swapankha, then one can understand the Lord and one's relationship with Him rightly. Otherwise, in the name of God, in the name of religion, in the name of surrender and so forth, one can be on all kinds of crazy paths. And then one can be going on for decades, for lifetimes, and still not get an actual vision of God and still not get enlightenment with God. So if we really want to connect with Krishna, if we really want to know Krishna, if we really want to know the truth, this is the way to do it. This is the way to rectify the covering and the false ego and etc., the offenses that are preventing our vision. So thank you very much. Questions, comments?
Yes.
Is humility something that can be cultivated, or is it something, you know, kind of like mercy that's bestowed, or
both? Which is the standard answer always to those sort of questions. Yes, it's mercy that's bestowed, but it's bestowed in response to our attempts to cultivate it.
Can you elaborate on how to cultivate it?
How do we cultivate humility? Well, I would say that the answer to that is given very nicely in Raghunath Das Goswami's Manashiksha, where he goes through all the subtle contaminations. I think it starts on a gross platform by serving the Vaishnavas, by really having the mentality of Prabhu, that the not only is Krishna my master, but the devotees are my master. And especially the Guru is my master. I am living for the Guru, getting a relationship of love with the Guru. Getting a relationship of love with the devotees, of affection, and getting in the mood that I am here to make them happy. I am there, I am sacrificing for their pleasure, and they are my proprietor. So doing that with other jivas as devotees of the Lord, that really is the main key to helping us to practice humility. That relationship with Guru and the devotees. I'm here to please them in order to please Krishna. I'm not here to please them so I'll get something for myself, but I'm here to please them because Krishna wants it. I'm thinking like that over and over and over and over again, bringing our mind back, as Krishna says, wherever the mind wanders due to its flickering and temporary nature, withdraw it and bring it back on the self. I am doing this to please Guru and Krishna because that's and the Guru and the devotees, because that's what Krishna wants. I am the servant of Krishna and the devotees because that's what Krishna wants me to do. That's what will make Krishna happy. And no matter how they treat me, no matter what response I get, I'm looking for Krishna's satisfaction in my activities, not my own. That's the main way to cultivate humility. Also, one can meditate philosophically on our incredible insignificance. We have almost inconceivable insignificance. The degree of our insignificance is phenomenal. And how can I think that I'm a very important person and that things are about me? It's not even logical. And to relish that position. Humility is not a matter of depressing, you know. That's Maya's trick, that humility means being depressed. Humility is freedom, that I don't have to pretend that I'm something that I'm not. It's being very authentic. Anything that's inauthentic is not humility. So anything that's pretense, lying, you know, immediately you can understand that's not humility. Humility is very liberating. So whenever we get a little glimpse of that, and I think all of us get a little glimpse every once in a while by mercy of what humility is, then we should relish that. We should hanker after it, and then we'll get more of it. Does that answer your question?
Madhukata, I'm sorry I had to mute you. I can't find him.
Anybody else?
Well, if nobody else is going to ask a question right away, I have a question.
Yes.
The examples in the Shastra are, if you water the root of the tree, then all the branches and leaves are nourished. Or, as you cited, if you serve the stomach, I think that was the example you gave, that, you know, all the limbs of the body are nourished. So it's natural that the first thing that a baby does is he tries to eat in everything that's around him. So wouldn't it be, you know, nobody has to train them. They just naturally want to eat, give food to the stomach. So even devotees of the Lord, when they come into contact with, you know, a spiritual path, and they may even see, you know, that, wow, this is really nice, but still they're attached to material things. Why is it that naturally, when we want to eat something, nobody's got to train us. We have to eat. Why is it that in the same way, once we find out, you know, serving the Lord is the way to satisfy ourselves, that we don't continue with that on a steady basis?
It's the same question as to why does someone who's become a drug addict or an alcoholic not immediately give it up as soon as they understand what they're doing? You know, it's the same kind of thing. Why do people who become addicted to intoxicants struggle so much to become sober? Whereas someone who's never taken those substances has no struggle at all. It's really the same thing. You know, I've never been addicted to anything like that, so I have no struggle. I have no thought at all during the day, on any day ever. Why don't I get a drink? Why don't I get a smoke? Why don't I get a drug? Such feelings never enter into my mind at all. It's just natural for me to avoid these things. But people who've become addicted, they struggle. They may eventually become free, but usually it's a long, hard struggle, and it's very common for them to have relapses, no matter what they know. And even no matter what their experiences are, they may go for years being sober and being free and being happy that they're sober. And then again, in the wrong circumstances, they relapse, even against their higher judgment. That's not surprising. So we have the same situation. We've become addicted to satisfying our senses outside of Krishna. And it hasn't given us any happiness. It's only given us distress. It gets worse and worse and worse. Our desire for the sense enjoyment increases, and our pleasure from it decreases in proportion. As our desire increases, our pleasure decreases. And it's brought us so much misery. It's ruined so many things for us. And we know that we don't want it anymore. But if we maintain any hope, oh, maybe, I'll be able to, you know, have a happy family and a healthy body. And if I just arrange things in this way, and arrange my finances like this, and arrange my health like this, and study this book on relationships, and then maybe I actually will be happy. So we maintain this doubt. And as long as we have this doubt, maybe I can be happy without Krishna. Maybe it's possible. Or maybe through Krishna I'll be able to be happy separately from Krishna, you know, the Sakama devotee. I'll worship Krishna to facilitate my trying to be happy separately from him. So then we keep falling back into sense gratification. Right? Like the devotee said to Prabhupada, sometimes we fall into Maya. And Prabhupada said, no, you're always in Maya. Sometimes you fall into Krishna. But the tendency to keep falling back into sense gratification is there. I mean, frankly, even at the stage of nishta, even at the stage of steadiness, still Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur explains that the mind's tendency is still to go to sense gratification. it's only at Ashakti, which is at the threshold of bhava, that we go to Krishna even without any effort on our part. Even at Nishta and even at Ruchi, there's still some effort, there's still some will. Oh, I want to think of Krishna now. So at Ruchi, I want to think of Krishna now, and immediately Krishna in the spiritual world is there. But when we don't say, I want to think of Krishna, they're not there. At Ashakti, they're there even when someone's talking about, you know, politics. And yet, even in bhava, there may still be some lingering desire for fame and honor and so forth. Some doubt that maybe I can be happy in this world. That's our problem. Therefore, enthusiasm, patience, and confidence. Anybody else?
Well, Dharma, it just seems like it's such a struggle to come to the point of surrender, you know, and it's really, really hard.
Yes. Once you become an alcoholic, it's really hard to become sober. That's true. And if you tell somebody it's not true, you're cheating them. If you tell an alcoholic you're going to become sober without any struggle, you're cheating. Now, it does get to a point where the struggle is over. It's not an eternal struggle. But yes, there's going to be tapasya. There's going to be penance. There has to be penance. We're offenders. And I was, in the news, I'm sure you're aware, Turkey shot down a Russian jet. So Putin is saying, all we want is an apology. Apologize and say you won't do it again. And the Turkish government is saying, no way, we're not going to apologize. Stupid idiots. They're looking for a war. But we have so much ego that it's such a struggle to apologize. And we see this in any human dealings. Person A offends person B. And you go to person A and you say, you should apologize. And they won't do it. They just won't do it. Why should I apologize? They should apologize. You know? Well, it's this huge struggle, and if they finally apologize, it's not even sincere. They're only apologizing because they don't want to get into trouble. So why does there have to be that kind of struggle? I don't know. They're stubborn fools. But it's not an eternal struggle. It's not an eternal struggle. And how long we struggle, frankly, is very much under our control. It's not just that some people only struggle for 2 weeks and other people struggle for 2,000 lifetimes because Krishna's mercy is discriminating, Krishna's whimsical. No, how much we struggle is very much under our control. Part of it is how contaminated we've allowed ourselves to get throughout various lifetimes. That's part of it. And the other part of it is how much we're willing to become humble. How much I'm holding on to my false ego as a shield. Bhaktisiddhanta compared the struggle to somebody holding on to a tree and telling the tree to let it go. What we're struggling with, and this is so important, is not something that's holding us. We're holding it. My attachments are not holding me, I am holding them. And my struggle is that I don't want to let go. That's my struggle. But yeah, for most of us it takes a long time. That's Bhagunam Janmanamante. That's our foolishness. What can be done? Somebody else?
I have a question.
Yes.
You mentioned that Because class today was about the desire of fame here in Mayapur. And you mentioned also that this desire for fame goes to, is still present even at Tubhava. So how does, and this is very obstructing, it's obstructing so much our progress. So how do we work with that?
Well, the desire for fame is exactly the antithesis of humility, so I've already answered. It's mostly through service to Guru and Vaishnavas. And honesty, being honest, at least with ourself and with Krishna. And then Krishna will help us. If we do those things, Krishna will help us. He'll show us the naked form of material desire. You know, he'll help. But that has to be done. You know, people who, like Prabhupada said, call your god brothers Prabhu, but you should not think of yourself as Prabhu. I had the bizarre experience a few weeks ago of posting on Facebook Mahaprabhu's statement, you know, Jivaraswara Paya Krishna Nityadash Ekal Ishwar Krishna Ari Sarva Vritya. Krishna's the only master and we're all his servants. And I said no one should ever think of themselves as Prabhu. And one devotee responded and said, why are you preaching Mayavad philosophy? I was speechless. And his thinking was, no, the men are the Prabhus over the women. Yeah, so how are we ever going to get rid of this desire for fame and honor if we think I'm a man and therefore all the women should honor me? I'm a Prabhupada disciple, all of the, you know, grand and great-grand disciples, they should honor me. I'm old, all the young people should honor me. Then how are we ever going to give this thing up? So therefore we should be very honest, at least with Krishna. We don't have to be honest with the whole world, at least with Krishna. And develop this mood of a servant. Really develop this mood of a servant. Relish being a servant. Get our joy from there. How much can I really find joy in serving the devotees, being the servant of the servant of the servant? How can I find joy even in serving the most insignificant of the devotees? In some way. How can I understand and interpret what I do with my life as being about service? Do I do what I do so people will say, oh, you're so wonderful? Or do I do what I do to make other people happy? And am I trying to make them happy to please Krishna? Because they may not become happy. If my goal is to make them happy, then I may also be disappointed. But if I'm trying to serve them so Krishna will be happy, Krishna is happy with even an attempt to serve. Just like the parents are happy with the child's attempt to talk. You know, even if the child's language is unclear, the fact that the child is making an effort pleases the parents. Like we have a two-year-old here, who his word for daddy is gaga, which doesn't sound anything like daddy. But because he has that particular sound, gaga, and it only means daddy, so we're pleased with that. That he's just made a correlation between a particular sound and a particular meaning, even though it's inaccurate. You know, little baby Krishna, when he was asked to carry something heavy, sometimes he would just move his arms and everybody would become pleased. Oh, he's making an effort to do something that he can't do. Is that all right?
Thank you.
Okay, I think we'll end here. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.